Hello, and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to a podcast on CelticUnderground.net. I am Harry Brady, and this is podcast number 225. By the older Cammerhead of the Celtic Underground team, Mr. Lackey Moore. For a variety of reasons, Lackey's taken a bit of a step back from Twitter and direct interaction with the frenzied nutcases of the Celtic internet land. So I thought it'd be appropriate, as we have a break in the football with the international fixtures, to have a bit of a break in the frenzied hyperbole of reviewing the Ronnie Dyler entry into the Celtic managerial stewardship and have a bit more of a considered approach. We discussed the season so far to date, Ronnie Dyler, our first impressions of how things are going, the transfer window, and what we see going on ahead. That's enough from me. This is me, Harry Brady, with him, Lackey Moore. Enjoy. So I'm joined by Lackey Moore. So how are you doing, Lackey?
I'm much better than I was. I've been going through rehab after my operation, and today I actually managed to play four holes of golf and had my first post-operative par.
Oh, excellent.
So I'm quite pleased. I just played with an 8-iron and a putter at Sutherness. Played the first four, and then my grandson played to the turn. Then we had our tea.
Excellent.
So I'm getting better.
Now, sometimes when you're going through health issues and recovery, it gives you a better perspective on the important things in life. So, Lackey, from your convalescing chair, how's it been as a Celtic supporter?
Well, I thought that the pre-season games, I thought they played quite well. The results were good, and I was quite... I know he wasn't entirely satisfied with the way they played, but they didn't lose many games, and I thought they looked okay. And then when they played the first qualifiers, I thought they looked quite good in that too. And every year the first qualifiers have been dodgy, because you never know how up to scratch the players are. But against the Legia Warsaw, the first game against Legia Warsaw, although it started well, ended up as a complete and utter shambles. And then I watched the second game on the telly at Burrayfield, and it was really poor. Then, of course, they repave and then back in, and then another shambles back at Celtic Park, which I didn't see. My movements that night with my recent article for the website of ploughing around Lough Fyne in a boat trying to avoid it. But, I mean, what struck me last week in reading about it and struck me again at the weekend listening to a game on the radio, and I think one of the earlier games was something you touched on, was that in one of the podcasts, that after half-time, they kept with a wee burst as if they'd sorted problems out and they were going to play better in the second half, and then they died again and just seem to lose their way. And it strikes me at the moment that what the team lacks is a leader. There's no one in the team that I think you would look to as a leader. I heard Tom English trying to suggest that Virgil had made an attempt to rally the troops that night, but you really need somebody in the midfield to organise, and I don't think they have anybody at the moment. I mean, I don't see Charlie Mulgrew as a schemer, and I don't see Chris Commons as a schemer. Probably a lot of folk would say I mean stupid, but my observation of Chris Commons is that very often he's quite uninvolved in the game. Mm-hmm. And then he scores a wonder goal, and maybe two wonder goals, and he's the man of the match. But he's not a guy who runs the midfield for you. and creates loads and loads of chances. I don't think. I'm not saying he's a bad player, but he's not the midfield general that that team needs.
Do you think we're missing Scott Brown?
I think we're missing Scott Brown in many ways, apart from just his sheer energy and his willingness to compete and his, I think, a refusal to accept second best in terms of a result. But they really need a footballer in the midfield. I think with Scott Brown and with Johansson, they've got two dynamic players. I had great hopes for Nurbito as a footballer, but he doesn't seem to have established himself. Why, I don't know, because I think he is a more subtle player than others. He doesn't express himself in the way that I'd hoped. I've seen quite a lot of stuff when he played in Israel. You know, there was quite extensive video through teacher, and it was beautiful stuff to watch. Taking the ball, turning, making passes, long passes, short passes. He really hasn't done that since he came. And yet I think that type of player is what they need. Someone who can hold the ball in the midfield and dictate the play.
And your overall impression of what's happening in terms of the way the team plays in the park is, do you think we are playing anywhere close to the way Ronnie Dyler wants, or do you think we're capable of playing close to the way Ronnie Dyler wants?
Well, I'm not entirely sure what it is he wants. I mean, he says he has a vision of how the game should be played. He made certain references to the way that the German team play and things like that. But I mean, they've got a really different class of players than us altogether. And while I've got great hopes about him as a guy who'll develop our younger players, I'm not sure that the way he wants to play, that we have the players at the moment that can play like that. If that German model is what he aspires to, it would appear that within the Norwegian league, he had his team playing like that. And I was actually reading an article in a paper yesterday. It was an interview with Henrik Larsson. Mm-hmm. Did you see it?
No, I didn't.
And he was talking about his vision of how the game should be played and how players should be developed. And it was fascinating. I thought, reading that, it was almost like reading the things that Ronnie Dyer has said about a way a team should work and how players should be developed. But at the moment, I'm not sure that he has the players that can do that, especially the players he had when he arrived. We don't know anything about the players he's brought in.
So, from your position, what was your view of the way that people then started to react to the results online?
I thought it was hysteria, utter hysteria. I couldn't believe the venom. It's still there, even this week, reading comments about various players and the manager, and particularly the board, and Peter Lawl, who has become the Antichrist in the eyes of many people. You know, rather than guys who are trying to do their best for the club, it may not be working very well at the moment. But in the past, they've done good things, and hopefully in the future they will. But some of this stuff is appalling. Even on Twitter, guys, the same thing, you just shake your head and you say, there's no reason to this. It's wholly irrational. It really surprises me.
But do you not think it's always been that way with supporters, I can remember? It's just that people now have access to a way to articulate that to a larger group of people. I can well remember people phoning up wanting Wim Jansen sacked.
Of course.
After we lost to Dunfermline in his second game.
I didn't realise there was so many of them out there. I thought it was just dafties that phoned Clyde and places like that. You know, but there seemed to be a huge number of people who go right over the top should Celtic lose. Now, I can understand. I was actually discussing it with Mrs. Lackymore the other day on our way to, we went down to Whithorn.
I bet she can't wait till you're fully recovered.
We went down to Whithorn to the annual pilgrimage the Diocesan Pilgrimage, and I was listening to the game on the radio, and she says it ruined her whole journey because I was getting so agitated listening to it. But I made the point that after the game is finished, you know, there's another game next week, and you'll still be a Celtic supporter. And there's no point in getting into that enraged position. I can see you might be slightly depressed for the week, and you talk to your pals, and they're slightly depressed. But some of the anger I see on the web astonishes me. I really didn't think we were like that.
And as I say, do you think it's a modern thing, or that football fans in general are less forgiving? That there's a more of a culture of we change it, or do you think they've always been like that? And it's just that people, you know, as I remember once in a podcast with Eddie Pearson talking about a supporters bus with 50 people on, there always used to be five idiots in it. The problem is those five idiots now connect to the other five idiots on the other bus who connect to the other five idiots, and actually what was five guys at the back of the bus who are paid in the backside suddenly sound like a lot of people. Which one do you think it is?
I think it's both. I think that folk have more access to communicate across a wider range of people. So, you know, if you're enraged about the fact that Ronnie Dyla sent out a poor team against Inverness Carlow Thistle, you can communicate with a guy in Canada who's equally enraged. In fact, that's one of the things that surprises me when I watch the games on Celtic TV, or sometimes listen to the away games in Celtic TV. I listen to it in that rather than, although I don't like the commentaries because they're so partisan. They're actually better than the BBC because they're so much enjoying their pain.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So I listen to the Celtic TV, and there's a wee window where you can comment. It's like a wall, the wall.
Uh-huh.
And some of the stuff in the wall is unbelievable. I'm surprised the Celtic have it there, because some of the folk are loonies. I mean, they really are. They abuse each other on the wall. And I'm thinking, well, why have Celtic got that facility for folk to abuse each other during match time from all over the world are doing it? Well, Joe Soap in Australia will call Willie Woodburn in Canada something really offensive, and there it is for you to see. And you think, wait a minute, it's only a game.
So do you think Celtic have made mistakes in the way that they've introduced Ronnie Dyla with his new system into the club? Do you think they could have done it better? Or do you think it's just one of these things when you're going through a cultural change, you have challenges?
I think maybe his early press conferences were very, very impressive, but maybe he laid out his cards too much. You know, the idea of a philosophical change. Maybe if he hadn't put that out so much, people would be a bit more understanding of the fact it's early season and stuff. I don't know. I can see the points about fitness and diet. You can see they look clear. Mm-hmm. And you look at certain players and you think, with the best will in the world, can that guy buy in to that model? But the thing about the philosophical change, the way he wants to play, do they understand that? Is he communicating that? There was a thing pre-season. They did a lot of training stuff on Celtic TV.
Yep.
The boys at training. And there was, you know, these wee drills they do, five against three and stuff. And you watch them doing it every week at the match. I mean, sometimes I'll go down to Maryfield, which used to be St. Joseph's College pitches, and there's a team plays there in, God, I can't remember what they're called now, but they play in the South of Scotland League or something like that. And they do all these wee drills. And it looks terrific till the game starts. Then they're rotten. That's why they're playing in that league, because they're actually not very good players. But they do all these wee fancy drills with each other. Every team does, even school teams now, appear to do it. But they were doing this drill, and whereas you used to watch it and nobody said a word, Colin stopped it. And he very clearly told players what they were doing wrong or what he wanted them to do. And if you could have seen the look in Van Dijk's face, it was contemptuous. He was standing there as if, who do you think you are telling me? And I thought at the time, I wonder if some of these players have got an attitude problem in terms of being told how to play in a different manner. It was just a thought.
Yeah.
He was clearly bored by it all.
I mean, I make reference quite a bit to the period of time when I interacted with some players at the changeover between Martin O'Neill and Gordon Strachan. And some of them were new players into the club and some of them were the existing players. And very much from what both of them said, or actually it was more from what the new players said and reading between the lines of what the existing players said, the impression I got was the biggest challenge in modern football is if you have had a team together as Celtic had under O'Neill and principally have had under Lennon with a core group of guys who are now mid to later 20s, millionaires, and somebody wants them to do something very different. They don't need to. No. Modern football, maybe I'll get a move, was the tone I got from the older players. I can't be bothered with this change. I'll get my agent to get me a move. If I don't get a move, I'm still going to earn a good living. I'm already a millionaire. Can't really be bothered. And the one slight concern I have is not that Ronnie Dyer won't be able to make the changes. It's just that that cultural change might require more of the younger players coming through, because you can see how younger players will buy into something. If you buy into this, you'll be playing first team football. They're more likely to buy into it. Signings will buy into it because, well, he's obviously bought them because he already perceives that they can play that system. Mm. And so you're what we're looking to achieve, which is new players in and bringing through the youth. So my slight concern then is we didn't clear out enough of the people who won't adapt, uh-huh, and bring in enough of the new people, yeah, for it, for the change that needs to happen in 1 year and for the breathing space that Ronnie Dyler then needs to allow him over a 2-3 year period to change the culture of our under 21 so that they start coming through.
When you referred back to Strachan, I remember they asked Strachan what was the biggest surprise he got when he took the Celtic job. Mm-hmm. He said Sean Maloney. He said he had no idea what a good player Sean Maloney was. And I think that's because Sean Maloney had always lived in the shadow of these great guys.
Yep.
Who were playing up front and competing with him. And of course, I think he ended up player of the year that year, did he not?
Mm-hmm.
Because somebody believed in him and gave him a chance. And football will laugh their heads off when I say this. I said to the missus the other day, they could do a lot worse than bring Sean Maloney back. Because in terms of a footballer who could maybe be that channel in the midfield, he's probably under pressure.
Well, no, I don't disagree. I mean, for me, if you go back over the 5 or 6 or 7 years that we've been doing Celtic Underground, I think Sean Maloney's a great player. I love Sean Maloney. He's the best talent that we've produced at Celtic Park. For some reason, in his second spell at Celtic, he couldn't seem to string more than 30 minutes together without being injured.
That's correct.
Then went down to England and played games.
I read an article about that. In one of the Sunday papers, one of the heavies, and they were looking at Maloney and they suggested that he'd actually come to a point where he realised that he was trying too hard.
Right.
Training too hard, trying too hard on the pitch, and that's why he was getting these injuries. And he had learned better as he got older how to manage his body and that's why he played so many games for Wigan. But even there, he had a couple of bad injuries. Mm-hmm. So it was at first, if I remember rightly, Martinez, although he'd signed him, I don't think he played him. And then towards the end of the season, he started to play him. And I think Sean Maloney saved them from relegation.
Yep. The other thing in the last wee while that was interesting was Ronnie Dyla's comments about the why have we bothered with a three-quarter size indoor pitch? Why didn't we just build a full one? Which I remember at the time when we did it thinking, surely we wouldn't have saved that much money by doing a three-quarter pitch instead of a full-size pitch.
I saw comments in Kerry Dale Street about that, and they were saying how Gordon Strachan had been really annoyed. I remember Tommy Burns was really annoyed because he felt he'd been sold a bill of goods. He was promised a state-of-the-art academy, and when he saw the indoor facility, he was less than chuffed. And I could never understand why they didn't build it.
And the other thing that was interesting was Ronnie Dyla talked about needing to rip up the pitches that we've got and relay them, which, if I recall, I think it may have been this time last season when we had a lot of players out at the beginning. It was either this time last season or the season before, we had a lot of players out injured. And Neil Lennon saying that they analysed everything and they were actually looking at, was it being caused by the pitches at Lennox Town?
That's correct. I remember that.
So either...
I wondered, was that why they spent some of their time training at Barrowfield? Because the facilities at Barrowfield are excellent.
Well, if my memory serves me right, that was, I think Lennon decided to go and train at Barrowfield to prove the point that if the injuries lessened, there was something at Lennox Town.
Mm-hmm. I thought at first it was part of, he felt that they were losing connection with the supporters up at Lennox Town. Whereas if you're training at Barrowfield and you go to Celtic Park, you see people, you're aware of what the club's about, you know, up there in the Ice Mountain, coming down to play at the big stadium on Saturday. And I think there was a wee element of that in his thinking. But I think it was also a lot to do with the fact that although it was a magnificent facility, the pitches weren't very good.
Yeah, and it's, I understand for a variety of reasons why you go to an out-of-town place. One of it is a bit of obscurity, that you will get privacy and not have loads of supporters hanging about. I get that, and I'm sure it's to do with land values and various other things. But I do find it odd, the concept that players aren't familiar with Celtic Park, they're not visiting it on it. And I know all the big clubs do this, but you're not visiting your home ground on a regular basis, so that actually it's not as fantastic a home environment as you would like to think that it would be for the players, surely.
Or Celtic Park?
Celtic Park. If the players are not there every day, they're not going to feel as attached to Celtic Park, which surely must have an impact on match days about your feelings for the ground that you're at every day.
Maybe the alternative could be the case that, like, you train away up there in the hills and then you come to this great arena. So the opposite could be the case, that you could be inspired by it and moved by it.
I suppose you're right. So we've...
But I think the supporters lost, because they used to see them daily.
Yep.
As they come in and out. You know, I remember, like Sir Tommy Burns would encourage that, because he felt, as that older generation did, that the link between the supporters and the players was central to what the club meant. I wonder even sometimes, is that perhaps one of the things that underpins all this anger, that they don't know them. They see them as pampered millionaires who always have earphones on as they come off the bus, and they can ignore people. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
And they're up there and we're down here. Whereas in the past, they used to go to supporters' functions. They used to be readily available for autographs and things like that. Now, unless they're ordered to go to the superstore and sign some strips, you wouldn't see them. I heard tonight, by the way, that Neymar get booked and fined for signing a Chelsea autograph as they come on as a substitute.
I was actually just going to say, I think that's a culture that's not peculiar to our club. And I know from speaking to people at Celtic, actually, they would love to have it written into the contracts that the players have to do certain things. But you'll just not get an agent allowing his player to sign into that. And the best example of it not being peculiar to us, that culture is just the prevalent culture across football, is Neymar getting booked at Barcelona for signing an autograph.
Ridiculous. I don't want to go back down memory lane, but I heard a thing tonight. Darren O'Day is training with the Celtic at the moment because he got a release from his club in the Ukraine.
Right.
After several times being stopped by armed terrorists, I think his wife says, "You better get home." So it's on Sports Scene if you get a chance to listen to it. And Sports Scene, and he's got an interview going up on BBC about his life in the Ukraine, which is less than edifying, I think.
Yeah, I did think actually when the European draws were coming around, it wouldn't be the end of the world to get Ukrainian teams at the moment because it. They might have some of the foreign stars decided just not to go back there after the summer.
He said that, I think, to Lawrence. But he said he spoke to Peter Law, and Peter Law said he can come here and train. You know, but he said that he didn't. It wasn't a regret, not something because you can't do anything about it. But he says he thinks he left the Celtic too soon. He wasn't patient enough. And he says, I remember Stephen Presley taking him aside and saying, you are at a great club. Don't make the mistake of leaving this great club just because you feel a wee bit frustrated. You're young. Take time before you make a decision. You know, and I thought, well, you know, Presley was making the point about Celtic being a great club. A lot of folk didn't like Presley. But I wrote an article once about Motherwell, where he wasn't playing. Mm-hmm. And the players all come off the bus. It's in the website, it's on the website. The players all come off the bus and just ignored the autograph hunters in the wains with the cameras and all that. Not one of them looked at him, straight into the ground. About 10 minutes later, Stephen Presley came across from his car. He'd packed his car. And as he walked by, kids saw him. And they went, oh, there's Stephen Presley, you know. He spent 25 minutes signing autographs, getting his picture taken with people. Nothing was too much bother for him. And my argument in the article was, if you were looking for somebody who was Celtic-minded, that day it was Stephen Presley, even though a lot of the fans didn't like him. Which, and I get that thing tonight made me think, what does it mean to be? Do they know what it means to be a Celtic player?
But it maybe touches on something about our policy. Obviously, it's been to focus on younger players and to, you know, this concept of bringing in, the phrase being projects that we can enhance and then sell on, and lots of talk about that. The point you've made there is there is also a need and a reason for having older heads in the team, and actually sometimes maybe older heads who have not been at Celtic all their career. Mm-hmm. So I also remember Adam Virgo telling me that when Roy Keane came to Celtic, that he was in the hotel at the Hilton on the Friday night before the game. He'd had his dinner. Did, you know, Celtic had a, I think Celtic had a room that the players ate in. Mm-hmm. Put his plate away, was about to go out the door, and Roy Keane got up and said to him, "Where are you going?" "Well, I've finished." And go, "You're going up to your room to sit on your own, to play your PlayStation and watch the television. What you need to do is finish your meal, give it time to digest, sit down with your colleagues and get to know your colleagues as human beings. Because if you know your colleagues as human beings, you will know them as players better on the park." Same type of thing as you're saying about Presley taking Dan O'Day around. That's someone who has been there and been the young player who goes off and does his own thing.
Mm-hmm.
But his maturity in football makes him understand the benefit of a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's maybe not something that a manager can make the players do all the time. and it's maybe somebody who they can, within the peer group of the team, that they can perhaps look up to, can do that. So there is a benefit of having older players.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, perhaps, is that a role that Scott Brown could fulfil, but at the moment he's not playing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, some of the newer players, I don't think they realise what a good player Scott Brown is and how an important player he is.
Yep.
As to that Celtic team. I mean, the guys that played with him know that when he's not there, they miss him. But some of the newer players might not.
Well, you touch on newer players there, so we've got some people in.
I think I said in the article, this dysfunction between a player being signed and a player actually becoming a proper Celtic player, that has to be addressed. That's Dyla's dilemma.
Yeah, and
these players he brings in have to become Celtic players.
And it was the thing that really came out to me from Peter Lawwell's interviews on Friday. The you know, it's not my fault interviews that Lawwell gave him Friday. He was making the point, and I understand what his point was, that, well, he didn't make this point, but of all the pot four teams, we have the highest wage bill.
Yes.
And the defence of that is because those other teams principally make up the majority of their squad from domestic talent, and the Scottish domestic talent isn't good enough, so we have to buy more of it in, and that costs money, and that's why our issue is. So Peter Lawwell makes the comment of, and the problem is the Scottish talent is not good enough. And some people then obviously see that as having a go at other clubs in Scotland. I saw that as an admittance that our academy system has failed. Because when we've got access to such an array of domestic talent, we hoover up the majority of talent, why are none of those young guys coming through into the Celtic team?
Well, it's interesting because I know it was on the Celtic website, so you've got to say, oh, well, they would say that. But there was a guy from UEFA was doing a study of academies around Europe, and he came to the Celtic Academy last year, and he sang, remember the structure of it, he sang its praises in terms of the way the boys were being managed, the way they were being coached, the whole care and development he thought was outstanding. And yet none of these boys appear to move on. Mm-hmm. Now, I heard a guy saying that McCart's a diddy, doesn't know what he's doing. How do you know? How do we know that? And someone says, oh, all they're interested in is winning trophies, no developing players. I thought, well, you must be developing to a certain extent or they wouldn't beat everybody else.
Yeah, and I think I said in the podcast with St. Anthony that one of the things I had heard was that the coaches from McCart down were very pleased with Ronnie Dyla because he was the first head coach who saw himself as the leader of the coaching division of the team. Yes. And giving them instruction. Well, that will obviously take time to feed through. But the other thing then is we patently do have talent, and it's a point I've now been, well, I know I've been making this point for over 10 years. And the reason I know I've been making this point for over 10 years is because the player that I used as the example to reinforce my point is a player we've just talked about. When people were wanting us to sign McFadden 11 years ago, I used to say, is he any better than Sean Maloney? To which most people would then say, well, I don't know. Well, exactly, because Sean Maloney's not getting a game every week. McFadden is, so you see McFadden at that level and you know what his ability is. But patently, 2 or 3 years ago, Celtic believed that Maloney was a better player than McFadden because Maloney's in the Celtic system and McFadden's not.
Yeah.
So the only difference then is as to if McFadden is a better player, well, the only difference can then be because McFadden's development's been better. Why has McFadden's development been better? Well, the only difference surely can be because he's played first-team football.
Exactly. The fact that they play first-team football hardens them up, makes them quicker, makes them think faster. I'm sure it helps them to play first-team football.
Well, and you know, one of the books that I have talked about on podcasts and websites is Matthew Saeed's Bounce, which is about 10,000 hours of purposeful practice. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that really struck me about that is the example he gives about the Russian ice skaters, where the couple who are number one or two in the world fell more in practice than the couple who were number 20 in the world. Because the couple who are number 20 in the world were practicing what they could do. And the couple who are number one and two in the world were practicing what they couldn't do.
Well,
and they were getting better at it.
It's funny you should say that, because I used to have this argument when I was the head teacher on Coburn's Path in Berwickshire. There was a really lovely woman taught the infants. It was only a wee school. It was my first point head teacher's post. And she loved the ice skating. And I used to when I say, see that lassie that was third? She never fell once. And the one that won fell twice. And she'd say exactly what you said. She was trying harder jumps. She might have been trying them, but she didn't succeed. And I thought, there comes a point where trying harder jumps, you have to get it right.
Yeah, no, I get that. But specifically what Matthew Say is referring to is in practice.
Yes, I do. I know
if we're practicing, the people who plateau because they can, what they then start to do is practice what they can do.
Yes.
And the people who succeed because they're practicing things that they can't do. And I don't know if you watched the programme just before the Commonwealth Games, the Sir Chris Hoy programme, where he went and spoke to gold medal athletes.
Mm-hmm. I didn't see it.
And the thing that struck me was all of them, without fail, when you're talking about the day after winning the medal, their first thought the day after winning the medal was, what were the areas that I wasn't good at? Because I'm going to practice that. Rebecca Adlington talked about, and I can't even remember what it was. It might have been her initial dive in, or it might have been the way, I think it was actually the way that she then, her final stroke as she was putting her hand against the edge of the pool. Mm-hmm. And how she changed doing that. So I think she broke fingers. Because the person who was coming second put their hand flat to hit it, whereas she went in with her fingers straight, and she broke fingers. And by breaking a finger, she finished a hundredth of a second ahead of the person who put their hand flat to put their hand in. But that mentality of, I'm already the best in the world, but the guy who's not, or girl who's number two in the world will be practicing their weakness.
Yes.
To better me. So I might have been the best in the world, but what was the thing that wasn't, what was the least good thing I did? And I'll make myself better at that.
Why don't footballers have that attitude?
I think a lot of it must come down to mentality at an early age. I think a lot of it must come down to the general culture within Scottish, British football, whatever level it is that we perceive this is not what it should be, in terms of a culture around hard work and exceeding expectation. So it must come down to all of those factors, and perhaps the money that's in football also means that these people have no, getting back to the point I made earlier about the established player who's in his mid to late 20s when a new manager comes in, why does he need to do the extra bit? Well, again, if you are, I remember somebody telling me about Derek Riordan, if Derek Riordan's mates are listening, I'm sorry, that Derek Riordan's mates were all signing on. And some of them maybe were not associating in the best of living world in terms of fluids and other substances that went into their body. It's probably the politest way to do it. And the guy's point was, so if you're Derek Riordan and none of your mates have excelled in anything financially, and you are earning £100,000 a year on £2,000 a week at Hibs, in comparison to your mates, you're at a level of living that nobody could have dreamed of.
Mm-hmm.
What's the thing that would drive you then to be the guy who earns £500,000 a year, because at £100,000 a year, you're already living the millionaire lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
And I have heard people talk about the challenge with the English Premiership Academy system is you've got guys earning, well, we've just talked about what salary might Dineer be on and what salary might Gaudette be on. And we've talked about them possibly being on £500,000 a year when they haven't played a game of first team football. Mm-hmm. Well, certainly Gaudette has played in Feyenoord or whatever, but Dineer hasn't played a game of first team football. Now, patently, they've got a different mindset, so that culture that we talked about is different. But the concept that you could be earning £500,000 a year before you've even made it.
But I was listening tonight, I mean, Alan McInally was talking on Sports Sound tonight about his time in Munich. And of course, they made some jokes about it, how he always talks about it. But they were saying how they asked George Alberts, and he was saying how the academy system in Germany is producing a conveyor belt of marvellous players.
Uh-huh.
Now, if they can do it, why can't we? I know they've got more people. England's got more people, but they're not producing great players either.
Unless
there's something wrong in our culture to know. So few of our players are reaching the top level.
I heard a great thing tonight. One of my mates who lives down in Leeds sent me an email. His boy is into rugby league.
Uh-huh.
And he's just progressed to the point of joining the Leeds Rhinos Academy.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had to go for an interview, a bit like going for an interview for a job. So it wasn't just his ability
uh-huh.
as a potential player. I think he's 14. So it wasn't just his ability as a potential player. It was him as a person they were interviewing. I think he's either 14 or 15. They asked him what A-levels he was planning to do. And he told them. First of all, they asked him, was he planning to go through with his A-levels? Yes, he was. What was he planning to do? Told him. What was his plans based on achieving results in his A-levels for further education?
Mm-hmm.
He then discussed what he wanted to do, go to university. They then said, that's the type of person they want within the Leeds Rhino Academy. They want somebody with that. And what they would do, they need to know all of this so that they can ensure that the training programme and the whole programme of his involvement with Leeds Rhinos matches in with his ability to attain his A-levels and to get to university so that he had options,
mm-hmm.
whatever happens in his career as a Leeds Rhino player.
Yeah.
That's what I would like to think is happening. I do know, obviously, we are trying hard with our connection with St Ninians and Kirkintilloch and a concept that we are producing young men who will, no matter what they do in life, they will reflect well in Celtic. But you can't have that in isolation of just Celtic. That's got to be all clubs.
Well, I mean, apparently Dundee United are making a fist of that as well, from what I hear. They're working through a school up there, and one would imagine they've got similar ideas.
Yeah.
But they're still within a culture within football that the education is not that important. Whereas abroad it is.
Mm-hmm. Well,
you know, we've often talked about how intelligent many of the foreign players appear to be compared to the ones we've got.
Yeah, and I suppose you and I probably have a similar thought process. Obviously, I can't comprehend anything in life where an education wouldn't be relevant.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the best player in the world, I'll be critical of the guy, but look at the carry-on that James Forrest got himself involved in last year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the story, lurid stories in the newspapers. And then you've got Tony Watt really appearing to had the golden ticket and tore it up. Like, by the way, he's playing in the Champions League.
Well, yeah, uh-huh.
But, I mean, he looked to me to be the real deal. But loose wire somewhere that they can't see the opportunity that's been offered, basically because they're not that bright. And that intrigues me how continental players appear to have not just a game intelligence, but a wider intelligence, by and large. I noticed a comment from Danny McGrain just before he had his heart attack. He did an interview in one of the papers, and he said that the foreign players work harder than the home-produced players. Now you think, what a thing to say. Mm-hmm. Because you're the bosses.
Yep.
And if they're not working hard enough, somebody should be putting their torch up behind. So what was the manager's attitude to the fact that foreign players were putting more effort into their training and their diet and their health, as Mikael Lustig suggested 2 weeks ago when he said it seemed to be the average lunch involved a bottle of Iron Brew and a packet of crisps for some of the players. Whereas he was quite happy to go along with Dyler's notions of diet. There's a complete gap mm-hmm. in terms of the way they see themselves as athletes. And it's not just about the fact they can run about the park quite.
Well, there's a whole load of things that is a consequence of that. But I suppose it's a symptom of a mindset that if you don't believe that that's important, when patently in every other athletic endeavour, the very top people believe that it is important, and you don't see you're not having that continual learning experience of thinking, yep, okay, I can see, I've watched that programme about Chris Hoy, look at those top athletes. I want to be a top athlete, so I'm going to have to change my diet. I'm going to have to change my health regime. None of that seems to have interested him. There's no, that you would expect the further learning as they're going through. And, that's one of the things I did like when I read about Ronnie Dyler coming to Celtic, was hearing that he'd gone, and even though Stromstad were starting to win the league in Norway, he was making appointments to go and visit other clubs because you never stop learning.
No. I get videos, DVDs from years ago when the likes of Darren O'Deary were kids, and you saw them in and about Celtic Park after training, getting pasta and stuff. So that culture providing them with good food mm-hmm. and a healthy diet isn't new to the club.
Yep.
But it doesn't seem to have permeated through to the players they're signing from our own country. I mean, there was a comment last week that said that dietitian girl had been there for 4 years and nobody had ever paid any attention to what she'd said until now. So they're paying a dietitian a salary. They're obviously paying chefs a salary because Ronnie Dyler said the food's excellent. Mm-hmm. And yet the whole purpose in it is to fuel these key individuals who are no bother shut. Now, if I'm paying you whatever it is, they pay them. Bloody good to do it, but you're not going to be here.
Yeah, but then it comes down to the manager, and I suppose that's where, in a continental environment, you have a director of football, and the issue with us being a bit vague in the blurring of the lines of that, but you have a director of football and that who's responsible for the football division, and the football division would include the dietitian and the sports scientist and the chef. And the director of football would have a clearer line of responsibility of saying to the manager or head coach or first team coach, whatever his job title is, I'm noticing the players aren't eating at lunchtime, or I'm noticing this and I'm noticing that. No, I don't want to do that. Well, I'm sorry, you misunderstand what I'm saying. I'm noticing the players are not doing that. Well, I don't want to do that. Well, they're doing it. And if you don't like it, there's a big door over there and you can walk through it and never come back. Now, you've got a bit of ambiguity in our system, but if I was running the club, and I know, getting back to your point, I know a lot of these things were in place under Gordon Strachan because he wanted to change these points because they weren't in place under Martin O'Neill. That if I had a manager who was allowing the players to not eat together at lunchtime, he might say, well, this is the way I run my club and this is the way I run my team. And I would say, well, you can run all the way down the car park out the door and somewhere else because you're not doing that in our club because we are better than that.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that since that the only manager since Dr. Joe, who actually, well, with the exception of the present one, who saw himself as the coach, was Strachan. The rest wanted to be managers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, John Barnes, maybe not so much John Barnes, but yeah, John Barnes too. John Barnes and certainly Martin, Tony Mowbray probably, and Neil Lennon all come from that traditional British management model. Whereas I think Gordon Strachan was more in tune with the notion of Dr. Joe, that he was a coach. Because he talked about being a coach. And I was listening to Dan the D tonight saying what a brilliant coach he was. And yet, he wasn't liked by our supporters in the way that Lennon was.
No, and I remember when Roy Keane got, I can't remember which job it was, when he got, there was one of the jobs that he got, and he talked about the influences on him as a player, and he said Brian Clough and Gordon Strachan.
Mm-hmm. He never mentioned the other guy.
No. I mean, granted, they did a bit of a fallout, but the fact that he was only with Strachan for 6 months and mentioned him, that's what struck me.
Yes. Uh-huh. Although, curiously, I think that Brian Clough, this is the wrong word, is to blame for Martin O'Neill. And in a sense, Martin O'Neill was to blame for Neil Lennon. Because although they were immensely talented, they were in a fixed mindset. Do you know what I mean? Any of the things that Martin O'Neill didn't like about Clough, he did as a manager.
Mm-hmm.
And Neil was much the same.
Yep. So
being a manager was important.
We've dissected, I'm noticing the time and obviously trying to keep the podcast a certain length. So we've dissected things. We're getting a break. We've had the transfer window. We've got in the striker, Skepovic. And the only comments seem to be that either people are saying nothing or people saying that we will get Guidetti as a striker on loan. Wait, do you see things being, do you see an evolution that the team will improve over the coming weeks? Are you hopeful? It's probably the best way to put it.
Hopeful. I'm hopeful. But the transformation he appears to be looking for, I would think, will take time. What I do hope they do is that they realise that when it comes down to it, you can talk about systems, you can talk philosophy if you like. It's actually men against men. And you have to win your personal battles on the field. If you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I've talked about this before, I think, when that great Liverpool team of Dalglish and all these guys were in their pomp. They used to go to, was it Kenilworth Road that Luton played at?
Yep.
The plastic pitch, which they clearly hated. I mean, it wasn't a modern plastic pitch.
You know,
it was garbage. And Luton used to battle at Furies, and Liverpool battled them for an hour. Took the stuffing out of them, and then played them off the park for the last half hour, and we'd win 5-0. And for an hour, the commentators would be excited because it was a close game. But Liverpool were matching them for physicality and strength and courage and speed and all the things that are important as well as skill. And then when they'd worn them down, they would beat them at football. And I've often said to my friend, if we compete and work as hard as our opponents in Scotland anyway, we will win. Because we're better than them. But too often we don't. Too often we go there and think we're Celtic and we can play in the Celtic way. And we're not allowed to.
Yep.
Because these guys have no respect for us. Greatly. Because they've got a right to play. And you've got to make them earn the right to play and then beat them. So I think that's the wee element in that of Ronnie Dyla. Of his transformation. Not that he becomes reduced to the Scottish way, but he realises he has to combat the strengths of the other teams. And sometimes that is, as Gordon Strachan said one day, he was very annoyed because I think a Celtic player got ordered off for kicking somebody and he was asked about it. And he says, well, it seems to me if you're hurt and you're finding it difficult, run faster, t- tackle harder and jump higher. That's how you compete, not by doing what he did. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
I think the team has to be aware of that, that they have to compete for the right to play football. And in recent games, from what I've seen, they've been pushed around by teams who are direct and fast and aggressive and full of running. Like Dundee were quite good in Saturday. Mm-hmm. In Sunday. They were quite a brave team. And although it's not a great league, not all the players are mugs. I would have put Stevie May in a heartbeat because I thought he was a good player and would have done a lot of the work that he seems to be looking for around the box now, more so than some of the ones we've got. I think Griffiths is at skill. I think, what's his name? Anthony Stokes is at skill, although he lacks pace. But I thought there was something about the way Stevie May played the game with a kind of appetite for the battle that I thought we needed for either of them to play off. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Well, I will leave it there because we've recorded for long enough, and I will just say, Lucky Moore, good health to you, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Bring me sunshine in your smile. Bring me laughter all the while. In this world where we live, there should be more happiness. So much joy you can give.
Hopefully you enjoyed the chat between myself and Lucky Moore. By the time we've played our next game, we will have Skepovic playing. Hopefully Guidetti in. The team will have played a bit more and trained a bit more together. We'll be at home. Everything will be all right, I promise. That was Lucky Moore. This is me, Harry Beery, saying good night. Good night.
Bring me sunshine, bring me love. Bring me sunshine in your smile. Bring me laughter all the while. In this world where we live, there should be more happiness. So much joy you can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years. Never bring me any tears. Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love, sweet love. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring